Hello, it is Sunday, June 9th, 2013, and this is episode 21 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell, and as usual, the thoughts and opinions I express on this podcast are mine and don't represent those of my employer. Well, it's been quite a rough week if you work for the CIA or the NSA or the White House. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. I try to steer clear of politics and privacy in particular for a number of reasons. But this story is just everywhere you turn. Apparently, a person named Edward Snowden has been feeding some top secret documents to The Guardian in the UK, and in particular, Glenn Greenwald with The Guardian has been writing some articles about these disclosures. The main highlights are that Verizon has been subpoenaed to provide metadata for all voice phone traffic that traversed their network, including both calls that terminate within the U.S. and outside the U.S. They explicitly exclude calls that are from one point outside of the U.S. to another point outside the U.S. This one really caused a big uproar when it happened. But the reality is that when a company receives a letter like that, there isn't a lot they can do. And the request was approved by a FISA judge, so there really isn't much recourse. And indeed, publicly talking about it is also prohibited by a built-in gag order in the request. Then we saw news that President Obama has asked the U.S. government to assemble a list of cyber targets in foreign countries. I'm not sure this one is actually that salacious. When you think about it, we essentially rely on our governments, whether it's the U.S. government or some other government, to maintain contingency plans. And so my interpretation is this is a contingency plan, and if they weren't doing this, they wouldn't really be doing their job. It certainly does look shocking when you see it, though. The third piece of information, which was probably the most contentious, was details on the PRISM program. And to be honest, I think we're going to be finding bits and pieces about PRISM for quite a long time, so I don't want to spend a lot of time speculating about what it is or isn't. But I'll tell you, as someone who is in the information security business and thinks about what is capable and knows what's written into the Patriot Act and how some of these warrants are being used, as well as things like the Utah data center being built, it really doesn't come as much of a surprise to me. Maybe I'm jaded and cynical, but whatever. Like I said, I want to put the politics to the side for a second and really talk about the security implications. We can assume, for instance, that the IT companies that participate in this program probably have some kind of facility, technical facility, whether it's a server that people log into or a feed, VPN, who knows what manner this happens in. But whatever facility is created is probably vulnerable to attack. And we saw something like this with a recent announcement about the Aurora attack from Google, where it appears that China actually had accessed a database of U.S. warrants issued to Google, and that in particular gave the Chinese government, or at least apparently gave them, some visibility into who the U.S. was monitoring, and by extension possibly showed whether the U.S. government was aware of foreign operatives. And my point is that a lot of times when systems like this are built, they have unintended consequences which can be used in unintended ways. So it's conceivable that some bad person is able to leverage the data or the feeds either from an individual company like a Facebook or a Google, or from the data in the NSA data center itself. Maybe it is an actual NSA employee. It isn't like we haven't seen government employees disclosing data before. But anyhow, people using that access, that data, in malicious ways, in ways that it was never intended. And so from the perspective of the government's position that this system is critical for protecting the American people, that very well may be true. And I'm not going to argue one way or another on this podcast, but the old saying that the road to hell is paved with good intentions comes to mind. It's going to be an interesting couple weeks coming up to see what happens with Edward Snowden and whether his motives are actually as he indicates, or whether possibly there's something more nefarious there, like providing data to other governments or potentially trying to hijack the recent cybersecurity talks with the Chinese government. All right, next story is one from InfoWorld on how bad Java users are at patching. So WebSense apparently published a report that says that 50% of Java users are running a version of Java that is more than 2 years old, and that as of the date of the report, 93% of Java users hadn't installed the latest critical security update, which was issued on April 16th. This is just unbelievable. I really am speechless about this. I don't know how word gets out any better that it's really, really, really freaking important to patch Java. In the wake of almost every patch, either right before or right after the patch, we see fairly widespread exploitation of the vulnerabilities that were patched. Anyway, I don't think I need to belabor this point with the audience here. I just am really stunned at how bad this is. The article indicates that some of the reasons potentially are that some organizations are stuck with old versions of Java because internal business applications were written specifically for that version of Java and they can't upgrade, or they will actually break their applications. And my position is that unless you're doing some really significant mitigation, like running Java in a sandboxed virtual machine or VDI kind of setup, you're really playing with fire. The next story comes from Network World, and they describe a recent report from Ponemon that indicates the average cost of a per record breach went from $130 last year to $136 this year. Of course, there's lots of caveats on that number. It depends on where you're at, what kind of records you're talking about, and so on. Also in the report were some interesting statistics that 35% of breaches result from human error and 29% result from system glitches, whatever that is. Maybe bad configurations or 0 days, I really don't know. And does not patching Java count as human error or a system glitch? All right, next story. Microsoft, working with the FBI in the US, disrupted or allegedly attempted to disrupt 1,462 different Citadel botnets. Now, Citadel, if you don't recall, is a very common banking Trojan, although it, of course, has lots of other functionality like just general keylogging, being used as a platform to attack other systems, sending spam, and on and on and on, all the normal things you would expect from a bot. There is an indication that they didn't get all 1,462 taken down. They didn't really say how many were successful versus unsuccessful, but in any event, that's a really very large operation. And it dovetails very nicely into the next story, which is that malware is increasingly using peer-to-peer communications for command and control versus the more traditional direct channels. At least that is according to a report by Dambala in an article written about that report in Network World. So basically, TDL4, one of the main pieces of malware out there, uses P2P as a secondary command and control channel when the domain generation algorithm method fails, whereas version 3 of Zeus actually uses peer-to-peer as its primary CNC channel, and Zero Access only uses peer-to-peer. And the obvious problem here is that when you are talking about peer-to-peer command and control, it becomes very, very difficult to do something like what Microsoft just did. So one thing I am not entirely certain of, and I would like to figure out the answer to this, is most organizations, at least in an organizational setting, don't allow peer-to-peer file transfers. And also, most firewalls or IPS devices have signatures for peer-to-peer. And one thing I wonder is, do those signatures actually catch this command and control traffic, or is this command and control traffic done using some more proprietary method and it's just using the same kind of constructs? Because if it does use normal, let's say, BitTorrent style communications that is detectable by IPS, this might be something that is relatively easy for an organization to detect and diagnose. But that's something to think about. I'm certainly going to try to investigate that some. And in the meantime, if you do see P2P traffic on your network, it may be an indication that it's not just someone downloading the latest porno video. In either event, you probably want to go and check them out. And if you happen to know the answer to that question, let me know. My final story tonight is Some Malware Trends by Jake Williams, also known as Malware Jake. On his blog, he recently put up a post on malware trends and signed malware. And if you don't follow Malware Jake or read his blog, I highly recommend you do. The link is in the show notes. He is a very insightful person when it comes to malware. His first observation is that TDSS infections are down while Zero Access is up. And he credits that to TDSS actually becoming too widespread and being readily caught these days. And Zero Access is stepping in to fill the void once filled by TDSS. He also points out that fake AV samples are going up pretty quickly, and that McAfee announced that they had detected 1 million new fake AV samples in this quarter alone. The other big trend is something I've talked about before, which is signed malware. And again, he talks about malware reporting having found 800,000 new malware samples that were signed in the first quarter of 2013. And he brings up an interesting point that I had never really thought of before. And that's that, again, these malware samples are being signed with a valid certificate. That certificate may be stolen, or it may be one created or bought specifically for the purpose of signing malware by the malware author. But his point is that you may be able to use these certificates as a method of locating other malware created by that author. So on the one hand, it's bad because we're moving more and more towards a trust model where we only run things that are signed by a valid author. And so if malware authors are able to sign their malware, we're going to implicitly trust it. But at the same time, it appears like it will also give us some benefit in terms of being able to identify potential malware samples by looking at which certificate signed it. And of course, that's going to rely on some amount of information sharing, because obviously somebody has to see it first and recognize that a piece of malware was signed by a certain certificate. Again, if you're interested in malware at all, I recommend you follow him. It's malwarejake.blogspot.com. Well, that's all I have time for this week. I definitely appreciate everyone listening, writing in, sending me ideas. If you do have any other ideas, things that you'd like to talk about, things that you'd like to hear me talk about, questions, comments, feedback, criticisms, things you think I got wrong, send me an email, info@defensivesecurity.org, Twitter, @DefensiveSec. You can find the website at www.defensivesecurity.com. I have links to all the stories to talk about in the show notes. I'm not a shy guy. If you, again, have any comments, I'm not going to take them personally. Well, anyway, I hope everyone has a great week, and I look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care, everyone. Bye.